Well, name calling. Name calling. There are a lot of different kinds of that, aren't there? When I was growing up, my sisters and brothers developed a nickname for me that they used rather freely. It was all done in fun and affection, but they would love to say Jeannie Weenie Green String Beanie. There was no meanness in that kind of name calling at that time. It was something, in fact, that even now I'll hear that from them and we'll laugh about it. But you know, school's getting ready to start this coming week, and we've all been raised, our awareness has been lifted up in terms of bullying in the school settings and in other places, and often bullying as its starting place in name calling. Then if we look at the global scene on the world stage, name calling can take on an even more devastating form. In 1994, the Rwandan genocide, a political leader incited the Hutus to be violent toward and to kill the Tutsis. And one of the ways that he did this was through name calling. He called the Tutsis cockroaches. It was a way of dehumanizing the other. And that was all that it took for some for there to be an all-out genocide. Language matters. Name calling can have distressing results. And so it was regrettable, in my opinion, this past June, when our president likened immigrants at our southern border to an infestation. It was reminiscent too much to me of that other setting. Yet, Jesus says, blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. This morning, I'm wondering, where is the blessing in name calling? Let me clarify that this final beatitude in Matthew's version, it's not arguing that in and of itself, name calling is a blessing. And that when others call us names, that in itself is a blessing. There's no blessing in reviling or persecuting others for who they are or for what they believe. Jesus is not condoning that kind of behavior. But he is acknowledging and saying out loud something that they know from living in the world as it is. And that is that that violence, words, and actions are a common part of life. After all, Roman forces were occupying his nation at the time. And ironically, they referred to themselves as peacemakers. And they referred to their emperor as the Son of God. It's in that context that Jesus utters these opposite words. Plus, his own people judged each other harshly. There was a lot of stratification in that society in terms of class and who was right and who was wrong. There were distinctions and judgments made about religious purity. All that was part of their world. And given the resistance of the past to the prophets of old, Jesus is saying to the people, I know that this is where you live. This is what goes on around you. I understand that. And he prepares his own followers to expect that there will be a certain degree of persecution. But Jesus does not instruct them to respond in kind. As tempting as it is to do so, Jesus does not instruct them to retaliate in the same manner that they are being treated, because their standard of their behavior is to be higher. It's to be other. It's not just the emperor. It's not just superiority in terms of community structures, but what is to be their guide is the reign of God. The Beatitudes are designed in a certain way. At the very beginning, in the first one, Matthew has it so that the context is the reign of God. And then in what we think was Matthew's last beatitude about the persecuted, it's also an echo of the reign of God. So Matthew and Jesus intentionally are bookending this teaching about blessing with the standard that is higher, which is the reign of God and God's righteousness. That's what's to guide the followers of Jesus. That's what's to matter to them. What is God going to do in the future? What does God think of us? And by what name is God going to call us? That's what's supposed to matter. When Nelson Mandela was imprisoned, some called him a communist. Some called him a terrorist. After 27 years of incarceration, he reached for a higher ethical bar. Mandela said, "As I walked out the door toward the gate that would lead to my freedom, I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison." And then as the president of New South Africa, he became a galvanizing symbol of national reconciliation, unity, and peace. So Jesus gets it. Jesus understands where it is and what we're up against. The Beatitudes are not some pie in the sky, high ideal of a fantasy world that never will be, and that we are somehow supposed to just ignore, except when we're in church on Sundays. The Beatitudes are for the real world. And the Beatitudes are to be practiced. They're practical. As C.K. Chesterton said in 1910, Christianity has not been tried and been found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. Therefore, in this teaching, Jesus provides us not only the high ideal, but also a method for meeting this divine standard. Look to the Beatitude in verse 9. It relates to the following that we've read this morning. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. So here we find, I believe, the way of blessing, the connection between the ideal and the living out of it. Jesus points us to the way of blessing. He points us to the art and the hard work of peacemaking. That is the means of responding to name calling and even persecution. I recall a scene in the film To Kill a Mockingbird in which 6-year-old Scout Finch is on her way to becoming a bully. On her first day at school, even in her starched dress and dress-up shoes, she gets into a fight with Walter Cunningham. They get into a fight. She calls him names. She wrestles him down to the ground. And come to find out, it was because she'd gotten into trouble with the teacher because he didn't have money for lunch. And the teacher was imposing on that a bit and questioning it too far. And she blamed Walter Cunningham for this spat she got into with the teacher. While they're fighting, her brother Jim pulls her off Walter. And to her surprise and consternation, Jim invites Walter to come back for dinner at their house. Around their table with her father Atticus, and chastised by their maid Calpurnia, in all these uncomfortable ways, Scout is being coached, mentored, formed into that difficult path of peacemaking. Because eventually she and Walter become friends. They're able to get past their differences to genuine friendship. I would say that they are getting to experience then God's blessing in name calling, peacemaking. No doubt you and I have plenty of questions that we want to ask. More questions, and what about this? What about that? Things that you'd like to explore that are just too much for the second half of a single sermon. We could do a whole series of sermons on peacemaking. Maybe ought to. There's so much more to learn about how to make peace, especially in complicated global situations and our own context today. May it suffice this morning to offer three marks of authentic peacemaking. The first is that peacemakers do not escalate the conflicts in which they find themselves. They don't return aggression for aggression. The second thing is they face those that harm them, not running away, face those that harm them with courageous, realistic compassion. And third, peacemakers hold themselves open to the possibility that conversion might happen, that forgiveness with accountability is a possibility, and hold themselves open even to reconciliation, knowing that there are no guarantees in their peacemaking, but they actively pursue peace by God's grace. Returning to the story of South Africa for a bit, Bishop Desmond Tutu was appointed to be to facilitate and chair the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was the alternative way, the third way, for that nation to deal with, to grapple with the wounds of the past, the atrocities of the past, in order to be able to reach for the possibility of healing and national wholeness. In his book, No Future Without Forgiveness, Bishop Tutu speaks honestly about the strengths and the weaknesses of the direction that they took. It was not a perfect process, he says, nor were the people involved perfect by any stretch. He tells the story there within that of Lucas Sikwepere. And it was Lucas who Cape Town policeman B.C.J. Barnard shot in the face, which left him blind. But he came before the commission, Lucas did, and he said in telling his story, "It feels like I've got my sight back after coming here." Tutu also describes how the parents of Amy Beale, who had been killed by a mob, were of course at first shattered, and then later found themselves able to say yes to the application for amnesty that her murderers wanted. And in that process, were able to support that amnesty for the murderers of their child. Eventually, they even set up a foundation for lifting up youth in the very township where she had been killed. These and other peacemakers experienced the Beatitude, I think. They experienced God's blessing because in situations of name-calling and persecution, they are thinking of God as their parent, God as their loving parent, their enemies as estranged siblings. And they long to hear God call them by this name, my beloved children. Blessed are you, children of God. Amen.